Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. It's the beloved end of the week edition. And, Jim, I'm sure you had Harvard beating New Mexico in your brackets yesterday, just like the rest of us.
Who did not? Yes. Isn't Obama. The Harvard guy didn't have faith in his old law school. So
yeah, I guess not. But you got to figure they would have worked all the geometric angles to figure out how to win that game. We'll see if they can do it again on Saturday. But the good news today is actually that the fight against Obamacare still goes on. There's the fight for repeal, but there's also the piece by piece effort, and a non-binding step in that direction happened in the Senate debate over a larger budget issue, and that is the repeal of the medical device tax. This has looked terrible from the get-go, but it's survived till now, and it still survives because this non-binding amendment is just that. But it shows by a 79-20 vote in a democratically controlled Senate that there is plenty of support for this. So you got to think, Jim, that sometime soon on a bill that actually counts, they'll do this. And if that margin exists in the Senate, there's not a lot the president could do about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that jumps out about this is just how bipartisan it was. We had kind of chuckled about Al Franken, who I believe called this a job-killing tax. What was once considered overwrought rhetoric from Republicans is now perfectly okay from Stuart Smalley, the fairly pretty darn liberal senator from Minnesota. Elizabeth Warren was one who was saying that she opposed this. So you're going to have a couple of Democrats from states that make a lot of medical devices. Well, apparently there's a whole bunch of them. And what kind of jumps out about this, Greg, is that remember during the whole Obamacare court cases, the argument was that this whole thing was a giant interconnected Jenga tower. And that if you remove one part of Obamacare, the whole thing falls apart. That's why they couldn't you couldn't take away the individual mandate. Well, now here's 78 senators who found one part of Obamacare that they absolutely hate and they believe is economically detrimental and bad for care and all that stuff. The chances of this Congress going back into Obamacare and fixing things, I think, is increasing with each passing day. And that is good news for us. It's going to be tough to repeal the whole darn thing, but it does show that there is a bipartisan recognition that this is a monstrosity of a bill with some parts that are just flat out unworkable and never going to meet the deadlines. And they look barely functional on paper, and now they're smacking into reality and seeing real problems. So I think there's going to be a new effort to revise Obamacare. And there's a lot of opportunity for the right. We probably won't be able to repeal the whole darn thing, but seeing Democrats admitting that, oh, you have to pass the bill in order to see what's into it, and it really is this Pandora's box of horror that we always said it was, is pretty pretty life-affirming, pretty good to confirm that we were right the whole time, and that Obama's promises were all not worth the paper they were written on.
Yeah, and seeing this vote in the Senate, which again is run by Democrats, I don't think it'll be too a big of a surprise if the president comes back in a week or two here and says, after looking at this, I think there's room for compromise, just like he did on the massive paperwork burden on small businesses that got repealed in the last Congress. So he'll try to jump in front of the line here, even though he'll be in reality dragged to that point. So on to martini number two now. And yesterday, the president in the Middle East was the bad martini. And it is once again today, in addition to visiting with the Palestinian leadership, or at least the Fatah leadership in the West Bank on Thursday. He then went back to Israel and gave a speech to Israeli college students talking about essentially why there needs to be Palestinian statehood, something that I think most Israelis support and certainly Prime Minister Netanyahu does. But here's how the president tried to paint this. Two different clips here that I think should get our dander up just a little bit.
But the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, their right to justice, must also be recognized. And put yourself in their shoes. Look at the world through their eyes. It is not fair that a Palestinian child cannot grow up in a state of their own, living their entire lives with the presence of a foreign army that controls the movements, not just of those young people, but their parents, their grandparents, every single day.
And then later in the speech, the president, in a very rare moment, going off teleprompter to make a point.
Talking to them, they weren't that different from my daughters. They weren't that different from your daughters or sons. I honestly believe that if any Israeli parent sat down with those kids, they'd say, I want these kids to succeed.
He's talking about Palestinian students that he met with earlier in the day. So, Jim, on the one hand, he's talking once again about fairness. A couple different points you could make there. The territories we're talking about, Israel has because, you know, all their neighbors tried to attack them in 1967 and lost. And so there are repercussions to that. And secondly, he didn't really talk about the need to stop terrorism much. The second clip, more personal, I just find it kind of annoying that it's perfectly fine for the president to invoke his daughters on everything from gay marriage to contraception mandates to Palestinian statehood. But if you talk about how their school has armed guards and other schools don't, well, then you've gone way too far.
Well, yeah, I mean, two thoughts that come out of just kind of Obama really does seem to believe that most of these things can come down from getting people into the same room and just talking to one another. And sadly, that is not it. The first thing is that, Greg, does any real observer of the Middle East and the decades and centuries of violence and you know, horrific terror attacks and all that we've seen, does anybody really think that the primary obstacle is a lack of empathy on the part of the Israeli people?
No, at least I would hope not.
I'm not saying that they're all peaches and cream. They defend their territory with great passion and vociferousness, and they, you know, are not inclined to take any more risks than they need to. But in the end, I mean, you know, you don't see that many Israelis calling for the extermination of the Palestinian people, you know, whereas sadly the reverse is not true. So when Obama says, oh, I met these Palestinian kids and they're so nice, they're nice kids, Greg. All these ones who've passed through a security check to make sure they didn't have any raving maniacs sitting in front. Like I'm sure there are really wonderful Palestinian children. Look, we all do want to see them live, you know, happy, peaceful lives in kumbaya neighborliness with Israelis and not, you know. The problem is that, you know, somewhere in there at a disturbingly early age, they get, you know, instructed that at least, you know, a certain portion of them get instructed that martyrdom is the absolute best thing that they can do with their lives. And instead of growing up to be doctors and engineers and teachers and all these other wonderful things, they do, that being a suicide bomber is what they need to do. Now, you know, when Obama meets with young kids on the Palestinian territories and says, you know, they're really good kids. Yeah, there is this horrible loss of innocence on the part of these kids. But the idea that the Israeli parents need to hear this is laughable. What it really comes down to is kind of the culture of the Palestinians. And it's, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, some of this blame you can put on Fatah and a whole lot you can put on Hamas and Hezbollah and all these other groups that basically tell kids from an early age that your purpose in life is to kill the Jews and drive the Israelis to the sea. And it's just this naivete that, you know, that comes out of the president when he does these talks. Yes, and, you know, you got applause and all that kind of stuff. But it really does come down to, you know, if the Israelis were just nicer, the entire Middle East peace process would get kickstarted. And I just, you know, I don't think you can look at the history of this region, the history of the actions of both sides and come to that as a legitimate solution or a genuine, honest assessment of this.
Yeah, I mean, Palestinian kids, ask your parents why they voted for terrorists in 2005 to be their leadership, at least in the Palestinian parliament. That's how we got Hamas running that show and eventually taking over all of Gaza and raining down rockets throughout the president's visit. So, Jim, let's move from the very sobering and serious nature of the Middle East to a very nice final crazy martini for the week. As you know from living on the East Coast, you and I don't live that far apart, and most people around the country, spring's been a little slow to make its way into our temperature pattern here across much of the country. And so here's the story from one county in Ohio from the Washington Post. Quote, as severe cold grips the eastern U.S. on March 21st, Punxsutawney Phil's forecast for an early spring is best described as an epic failure. The prosecuting attorney of Butler County, Ohio, Michael Gmoser, I think is how you say that, wants the groundhog to pay for his flawed prediction with his life. Gmoser filed an indictment against Phil, which reads accordingly. On or about February 2nd, 2013, at Gobbler's Knob, Punxsutawney Phil did purposely and with prior calculation and design cause the people to believe that spring would come early. Contrary to the Groundhog Day report, a snowstorm and record low temperatures have been and are predicted to continue in the near future, which constitutes the offense of misrepresentation of early spring, an unclassified felony, and against the peace and dignity of the state of Ohio. Specification. The people further find and specify that due to the aggravating circumstances and misrepresentation to the people, that the death penalty be implemented to the defendant, Punxsutawney Phil. Gmoser went on to say that this was obviously all tongue-in-cheek, and he hopes everybody understands that it's a joke. So, Jim, Punxsutawney Phil, Doesn't see a shadow a lot, but when you see the shadow, you better be right, and there are consequences when you don't.
Kill Phil. Kill Phil. Now, I suppose we could say, oh, this is a waste of taxpayer time. You know, like, well, I think it probably took like 5 minutes to write this up. And frankly, I support the death penalty for that rotten little groundhog for telling us spring was coming when it's been so frigid lately. I back this. Look, you know, there's been this push against the death penalty in a lot of you know, a lot of corners of this country. But I believe that the death penalty for groundhogs may be set for a comeback. In relating to the very cold spring we're having. You know, it's time to get tough on erroneous groundhogs, Greg. You know, it's a law and order party. It's time to bring back some consequences to bad predictions.
Exactly. And, of course, as I mentioned, it's in the Washington Post. So the comment section in a liberal entity like the Washington Post is essentially typical Republicans, and it does not even mention that he's a Republican. He might be. You want to kill anyone you disagree with. So good to see that everyone can take a joke.
Never mind kill. Are groundhogs good eating?
I don't know. I don't eat a lot of rodents, so right. I'm not the one to ask on that. But
anyway, but yes, you know, kind of a, it would really add a whole new drama to Groundhog Day, wouldn't it, each year? That by March 22nd, the attitude would be, all right, let's see, you know. Meanwhile, there are a whole bunch of really nervous weathermen kind of shuffling their feet, looking at the floor and checking where the exits are.
Well, you know, this is a strong case for groundhog term limits, I think.
There we go. Exactly. You know,
He's been on the job for over 100 years.
Some new blood. Yeah. What did Nate Silver say?
I'm sure whatever it was perfectly accurate. But Jim, speaking of warmer temperatures, have a great time on vacation next week. And we'll talk to you a little bit after that.
Looking forward to seeing you on April 1st or thereabouts, and that is not an April Fool's Day joke. I will be back then. So.
Excellent. Well, have a great time. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. He's Jim Garrity of National Review. Join me and probably Dan Foster or one of the other folks over at National Review Online on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.